If you ever find yourself traveling down the Mediterranean coast and you visit the modern Lebanese city of Tyre, which, by the way, is known today as Sur, you'll find yourself standing on a peninsula.
Right, yeah, very solid piece of land.
Exactly. It's just a solid piece of land jutting right out into the ocean. But here is the really mind-bending geographical fact that we are starting with today. If you had stood in that exact same spot, say, 2,500 years ago, you would have been completely
It'd
underwater.
be totally submerged.
Yeah, because back then, that city was actually an island. I mean, the ground you'd be standing on today was quite literally built out of the recycled ruins of an ancient city, a city that was scraped down to the bare bedrock and just cast into the sea by none other than Alexander the Great.
It's just, well, it's one of those rare instances where human history and military engineering and geography all kind of collide to fundamentally redraw the map of the world.
Literally redraw the map.
Exactly. And what makes this event so particularly significant is that this wasn't just, a random act of architectural violence or some general just acting on a whim.
Right. It was actually the culmination of a centuries-old geopolitical grudge. So today we are taking a deep dive into a stack of biblical texts, historical timelines, and ancient military accounts. And we're going to explore the ancient city of Tyre from a Christian perspective.
Which is such a fascinating angle because it's so specific.
It really is. Our mission today is to unpack one of the most specific, dramatic, prophetic fulfillments in human history. We are looking at how an ancient biblical prophecy by the prophet Ezekiel actually predicted Alexander the Great's unprecedented military tactics. And he did this centuries before Alexander was even born.
To really appreciate the magnitude of what happened here,
Yeah.
we first have to establish what Tyre actually was in the ancient world.
Right, because it wasn't just a regular
No,
town.
not at all. Tyre wasn't just a blip on the radar. It was a massive Mediterranean superpower.
Yeah.
It was basically the wealthy, dominant heart of the Phoenician merchant empire. I mean, it's mentioned nearly 60 times in the Bible. Geographically, it consisted of two distinct parts. You had this mainland settlement, which was known as Old Tyre, sitting right there on the coast. And then about half a mile offshore, you had this heavily fortified island city just rising straight out of the water.
So it's this island fortress with these massive walls paired with a bustling mainland port.
Yeah, exactly.
But, to understand why Tyre ends up in the crosshairs of biblical prophets in the first place, we really need to look at its early relationship with ancient Israel, because they actually didn't start out as enemies,
Right.
right?
No, quite the opposite.
Yeah, if you look at the royal records from the reigns of King David and King Solomon, Tyre is essentially Israel's primary contractor.
That's a great way to put it. King Hiram of Tyre was a major partner to Solomon. Hiram supplied massive amounts of that famous Lebanese cedar wood, along with highly skilled craftsmen and builders, to construct the first temple and the royal palace in Jerusalem.
Wow. So they literally provided the raw materials and the expertise to build the spiritual center of Israel.
They really did. They had this incredibly close, mutually beneficial trade alliance.
But, well, centuries pass, and as we know, geopolitical alliances shift. The relationship violently sours. Eventually, Jerusalem is besieged and completely destroyed by the Babylonians.
Yeah.
And Tyre's reaction is what sets everything in motion here. They don't mourn their old ally, they rejoice. I mean, they basically throw a party at Jerusalem's downfall, seeing the elimination of a rival as, a way to increase their own wealth and monopolize regional trade.
And it's that pride,
Yeah.
specifically that rejoicing over the destruction of the very temple their own ancestors helped build. That's what brings these heavy judgments from the biblical prophets.
It's like, imagine your closest, most reliable business partner,
Right.
the one who literally helped build your company headquarters, and suddenly they're cheering and throwing a party when you declare bankruptcy.
It's an ultimate betrayal.
Exactly. So prophets like Isaiah deliver what, in the ancient Near Eastern context, was called an oracle. Basically, a formal, highly poetic pronouncement of impending doom against a city or a nation. But it's really the prophet Ezekiel who zeroes in on the actual mechanics of Tyre's downfall.
He gets incredibly specific.
Yeah.
In Ezekiel chapter 26, God promises that many nations will come against Tyre, crashing against it like ocean waves.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of the prophecy, because Ezekiel doesn't just write a generic check saying, you know, your city will burn or your people will be captured.
No, it's much stranger than that.
Right. The prophecy states that Tyre's walls will be broken down, and its stones, its timber, and its very dust will be scraped bare and thrown into the middle of the sea.
The text specifically says Tyre will be left a bare rock.
A bare rock. And practically speaking, I mean, wiping a city off the map down to the bare bedrock requires an insane amount of manpower.
It makes no sense militarily.
Exactly. If you're an ancient military commander, you might burn a city to the ground. You might knock down its defensive walls. You might occupy it. But you do not spend the massive amount of calories, logistics, and man hours required to literally sweep up the dirt of a ruined city and throw it into the ocean. That just defies all conventional military logic.
It really does.
Right.
Which is exactly why the timeline from prophecy to fulfillment is so heavily scrutinized by historians.
Right.
And Ezekiel actually gives us precise chronological data to track this. Ezekiel 26, verse 1 explicitly dates the prophecy, stating, I think it says, in the 11th year, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me.
Okay.
This refers to the 11th year of King Jehoiachin's exile. So when you map that onto our modern historical calendar, it places the prophecy precisely in 587 or 586 BC.
Right, as the smoke is basically still clearing from the Babylonians destroying Jerusalem.
Exactly.
So Ezekiel makes this incredibly specific prediction. How long until the first army actually shows up?
Almost immediately, actually. The first waves of this judgment arise right on cue. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, marches his forces to the Mediterranean coast and attacks Tyre.
Okay, so this is the Babylonian Empire at its peak.
Right. From 586 to 573 BC, Nebuchadnezzar spends 13 brutal years laying siege to the mainland city of Old Tyre.
Wait, 13 years?
13 years.
The logistics of sustaining an army outside a city for over a decade are just staggering. I mean, you have to constantly forage the surrounding countryside. You got to maintain supply lines stretching all the way back to Babylon.
Yeah, not to mention dealing with disease, desertion, low morale.
Exactly. But he persists, and he successfully destroys the mainland settlement. Old Tyre is totally crushed. But there's a massive strategic loophole here.
A huge one. Because Tyre is two cities.
Right, the island.
Seeing Nebuchadnezzar systematically dismantle their mainland city over a decade, the wealthy Tyrians just simply pack up their riches, their valuables, their leadership, and they retreat to that fortified island half a mile offshore.
And Nebuchadnezzar, for all of his overwhelming land-based military might, has absolutely no navy.
None. He cannot touch them out there.
I just picture him standing on the beach in his armor, just glaring at an island half a mile away.
That's essentially what happened. The Babylonian forces were completely frustrated. So the 13-year siege eventually ends in this sort of geopolitical compromise.
What kind of compromise?
Well, Tyre agrees to nominally submit and pay tribute to Babylon, but that offshore island fortress, it survives completely intact.
Wow.
Ezekiel actually acknowledges this partial military outcome later in his own book, noting that Nebuchadnezzar's army worked hard, but got no real reward for it.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me play the skeptic for a second here.
Go for it.
If Nebuchadnezzar just leaves the ruins on the beach and goes home, doesn't that mean Ezekiel's prophecy technically failed?
How so?
Well, he destroyed the mainland, sure, but he didn't throw the stones and the timber into the sea. He certainly didn't scrape the dust down to bare rock. The city was not thrown into the ocean.
Right. And that is exactly what historical critics pointed to for a very, very long time.
It seems like a glaring hole.
It does. But this is where the grammatical precision of the original Hebrew text becomes absolutely vital. The prophecy didn't fail at all. It was actually just waiting for the second act.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There is a crucial, incredibly subtle shift in Ezekiel's text. In Ezekiel 26, verses 7 through 11, Ezekiel uses the singular pronoun he to describe what Nebuchadnezzar would do.
Okay, he.
The text says he will slay with a sword. He will break down your towers. He will direct the blows of his battering rams against your walls. And history shows that Nebuchadnezzar did exactly that to the mainland city.
Right.
But then in verse 12, the text suddenly shifts pronouns. It shifts from the singular he to the plural they.
Whoa. So it changes the subject of the action entirely.
Exactly. Verse 12 says, quote, they will plunder your wealth and loot your merchandise. They will break down your walls and destroy your fine houses and throw your stones, timber, and rubble into the sea.
That completely changes how you read the text.
It really does.
It's basically saying, okay, he, meaning Nebuchadnezzar, will destroy your mainland city, but they, someone else entirely, will throw the remains into the ocean.
Yes, and this ties perfectly back to verse 3, where Ezekiel prophesied earlier that God would bring many nations against Tyre, quote, like the sea casting up its waves.
Ah, wave after wave.
Nebuchadnezzar was only the first wave. He accomplished the first phase. The prophecy explicitly leaves grammatical room for a future multinational force to arrive and finish the bizarre job that the Babylonians left undone.
Okay, so the text basically just sits there. For 2.5 centuries, mainland Tyre lies in ruins on the coast. The island fortress remains totally untouched, and the prophecy is just waiting for they to show up.
Just waiting. And that brings us to 332 BC.
Enter Alexander the Great.
Yes, Alexander arrives on the Mediterranean coast, leading a massive multinational army of Greeks, Macedonians, and all these allied forces.
So he literally fulfills the many nations aspect of the prophecy, completely separate from the Babylonians.
Exactly. And as he sweeps south toward Egypt, he demands Tyre's surrender.
And the Tyrians, sitting out on their little island, just laugh him off.
They totally dismiss him.
I mean, you can't blame them. They've been safe out there for 250 years. They have these massive walls rising 150 feet straight out of the water. They have a dominant navy.
They're feeling pretty confident.
Very confident. They basically send a message saying, you know, Nebuchadnezzar couldn't get us. You can't get us. We are not surrendering. But from Alexander's perspective, leaving an intact island fortress just sitting there was a massive strategic liability, right? He couldn't just walk past it.
Not a chance. If Alexander marches his army into Egypt and leaves Tyre unconquered, he is leaving a massively powerful Persian allied naval base right in his back.
Right. They could cut him off.
Yeah. That fleet could sail out, cut off his supply lines, or even launch an attack on Greece itself while he is away. So Alexander is faced with the exact same problem Nebuchadnezzar had. He's a land conqueror looking at an island fortress, and at the start of this siege, he lacks a sufficient fleet to take them on by sea.
But unlike Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander refuses to compromise.
He was not a guy known for compromising.
No, definitely not. If he doesn't have a navy to sail to the island, he decides, well, I'm just going to walk there. But to do that, he has to build a road first.
And this is exactly where the engineering logistics perfectly align with the ancient text.
Okay.
Alexander's engineers realize that to reach the island, they need to construct a massive land bridge, which is known as a causeway, or a mole stretching half a mile across the Mediterranean Sea.
Wow.
And the water near the island was up to 18 feet deep. To build a solid mole capable of supporting heavy siege engines and an entire marching army, you need a colossal amount of building materials.
I mean, you essentially have to build a highway across a running river by just throwing enough rocks and debris into the water until you can literally drive over the pile.
Exactly, just brute forcing it to overcome the Mediterranean currents.
But where on earth do you find millions of tons of stone and timber on a sandy, barren coastline?
Well, you look at the ruined ghost town right behind you.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Alexander's army turns around and looks at the ruins of mainland old Tyre that Nebuchadnezzar left behind 250 years earlier. And they just go to work.
Incredible.
The engineering of a mole involves driving these massive timber piles deep into the seabed to create a framework, and then packing the inside of that framework with heavy stone.
So they completely dismantle the old mainland city.
Every bit of it.
Every stone, every timber left standing, they throw it all into the water to build their road. But I mean, they're doing this under active naval bombardment, right? The Tyrians aren't just politely watching this happen.
Oh, absolutely not. As the mole gets closer to the island, it comes within range of Tyrian archers and catapults on the city walls.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It was. Tyrian ships are constantly sailing up to the work crews, firing arrows, and they're even deploying divers to cut the moorings of Alexander's construction barges.
So what does Alexander do?
In response, Alexander builds two massive wooden siege towers. These things stand over 160 feet tall, and they're covered in raw animal hides to protect against flaming arrows. He places them at the very end of the mole to protect his workers.
But the Tyrians figure out a way around that, too. I remember reading they take an old horse transport ship, fill it to the brim with dry branches, pitch, and sulfur, and hang these cauldrons of oil from the masts and just light the whole thing on fire.
A literal fire ship.
Yeah. They drive this massive fire ship straight into the end of the mole, and they burn Alexander's siege towers all the way down to the waterline.
It was a devastating setback for the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Alexander doesn't quit. He just orders the mole to be rebuilt and significantly widened so it can hold more defensive structures.
But wait, if he widens it, he needs even more material.
Exactly.
And when his soldiers run out of the big stones and the timber from the ruins... They start scraping the dirt. They literally scrape the dirt, the dust, and the debris of Old Tyre down to the bare bedrock just to finish paving this causeway. For 7 grueling months, Alexander's soldiers are out there carrying the dust and stones of Old Tyre and casting them into the sea. I mean, it is a literal physical fulfillment of Ezekiel's ancient vision. The dust was scraped to bare rock and thrown into the sea.
And after those 7 months of relentless labor, the causeway is finally finished. Alexander brings up a newly acquired fleet from his allies to blockade the Tyrian navy.
So the trap closes.
Yes. His massive siege engines roll right across this man-made land bridge. They batter down those 150-foot walls, and the island city is brutally sacked. The impregnable fortress that survived the Babylonians finally falls to the Greeks, and they traversed a bridge made from the ruins of their own ancestors to do it.
It's the ultimate spite project. The logistics and the sheer willpower involved are just astounding. But, you know, Alexander didn't just destroy a city here. He accidentally broke the local geography.
Oh, completely.
Because dropping millions of tons of rock and timber into the Mediterranean completely altered the coastal currents, right?
This is where the long-term geographical aftermath is so fascinating. So the natural flow of sand and sediment along a coastline is known as longshore drift. Before Alexander, the water flowed freely between the mainland and the island. But that massive man-made mole acted as a permanent barrier. It completely disrupted the longshore drift.
But what happened?
Over the next 2,300 years, coastal currents constantly deposited sand and silt against the sides of that stone bridge.
So nature basically paved over Alexander's work.
Exactly. The sand built up against the ruins he cast into the sea, widening the causeway century after century. Geologists actually call this formation a tombolo, which is an island attached to the mainland by a narrow piece of land, usually a sandbar formed by wave refraction. Because of this tombolo effect, the modern Lebanese city of Tyre sits on a solid peninsula today, not an island. The physical geography of the earth was permanently transformed by the fulfillment of that prophecy.
That is just wild. And, you know, that physical transformation kind of sets the stage for a massive spiritual shift when we move into the New Testament.
It really does.
Because when you look at the full timeline here, you're watching a city go from being this arrogant enemy of God, judged by the prophets, to taking on a completely different role in the time of Jesus and the early church.
Yeah, if we look at the Gospels, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record this,
yeah,
Jesus actually uses Tyre, along with its sister city Sidon, as a profound teaching tool.
How so?
Well, despite its dark history of judgment, Jesus uses Tyre as a prime example of a Gentile city that actually would have repented if they had seen the miracles he was performing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in Matthew 11, he rebukes the unrepentant cities in Israel, saying that if the miracles done in them had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes.
Wow. So he is basically telling his audience, you know, you have the Messiah right in front of you and you don't believe, but even the infamous city of Tyre would have recognized me.
Exactly.
That's a massive statement to a first century Jewish audience that would have absolutely known Tyre's history.
It's huge. And he doesn't just talk about them either. Jesus actually visits the region of Tyre and Sidon.
Mm-hmm.
And he heals people there.
He actually goes there.
He does. And this grace extends right into the early church as well. In the book of Acts, in chapter 21, we see the apostle Paul traveling to Jerusalem and his ship lands at Tyre.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah, Paul actually seeks out the disciples living there.
Right.
And stays with them for 7 days.
Man, when you step back and look at the whole picture, the arc is incredible. I mean, you have a city that starts out supplying cedar wood for Solomon's temple.
Right.
Then it turns its back, celebrates Jerusalem's destruction, and receives an oracle predicting it will be scraped into the ocean. Then it endures a 13-year logistical nightmare of a siege by Babylon.
The first wave.
Right.
Yeah.
Then it just sits for 250 years waiting for a pronoun shift from he to they to come true in a biblical text. Then Alexander the Great physically throws it into the sea to build a half-mile bridge because he just can't leave a naval base at his back. And eventually, out of all that destruction, it becomes a New Testament symbol of potential repentance and a safe harbor for early Christians like the Apostle Paul.
It is a testament to the fact that biblical history isn't just, you know, a series of isolated events. It's a deeply connected narrative spanning millennia where geography, military engineering, and prophecy all intersect perfectly.
So to summarize the journey for everyone today, We started with the cedar wood of Solomon's temple. We waded through the 13-year siege of Nebuchadnezzar on the mainland. We uncovered a 250-year-old grammatical shift where he became they. And finally, we watched Alexander the Great build a highway out of a ruined city to conquer an unconquerable island, completely permanently altering the coastline in the process.
And I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to kind of mull over. Consider the profound irony and the long arc of history we've just explored. The very stones and timbers of old Tyre, which stood tall and proud while the city rejoiced at the destruction of God's temple in Jerusalem, were physically repurposed by Alexander to pave the road for their own total destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, centuries later, the dust of that same judge city, the very rubble cast into the sea to form that tombolo, became the geographical ground where Jesus walked, and where early Christians found safe harbor and fellowship.
Wow.
It challenges us to think about how the ruins of our past, even the things that seem utterly destroyed or judged beyond repair, are constantly being reshaped by time and grace into something entirely new.
What an image. The ruins of the past forming the foundation for the future. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We invite you to keep exploring the history that is hidden right beneath our feet. Because the next time you look out at a peninsula or a city or even just a bare rock on the shore, remember, you might just be looking at the final act of an ancient prophecy. Catch you next time.